Hey everyone, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 6, Episode 44, The Remaining Suspects. In this episode, Bob covered the Melgar's housekeeper, Liz's ex-husband, and Jim's brother, Erwin. Now, we got a lot of discussion on social media, and I've got a lot of questions here for you, Bob, so let's get right into this.
Let's do it.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's start off with a post from Heather. She says, I'm not sure if it's been mentioned, but season 2 of The Confession Tapes is out on Netflix. And I know, Bob, you've been watching it, so what do you think?
Yeah, I meant to post about this the night I started watching it, but that happened to be the same night that Sandy's appeal brief was filed, the response brief by the state, so I didn't get a chance to post about it because I want to talk about it. So I'll get onto the fan page and we can talk a little bit more about it. But yeah, if you haven't seen The Confession Tapes, came out last year, the year before, a Netflix series where they look at some very clearly and some potential false confessions, where you see the actual interrogation tapes and then see the elements of the case that show that the police officers were using some questionable tactics to incite a false confession. And season 2 it's short. I think it's only 4 episodes, but man, I can tell you, if you haven't seen it yet, Episode 2 of Season 2 of The Confession Tapes on Netflix will make you lose your mind. I mean, I was screaming at my TV. Becky was screaming at the TV, like, you have to be kidding me. So it's very good. I love watching any kind of shows like that. I've mentioned before a show called Criminal Confessions on Oxygen is another great one. I'm waiting for the new season of that to come out. But I love, just for educational purposes, is kind of training to watch anytime we can see an interrogation taking place and see how people are reacting and the tactics the officers are using. And sometimes, you know, in the confession tapes, usually you're looking at actual true confessions most of the time, as opposed to that's in the criminal confessions. And the confession tapes, you see kind of the other end of that, what happens when it goes wrong. So highly recommend checking out The Confession Tapes on Netflix season 2 and season 1 if you haven't seen it yet.
All right, Tina says, I'm not sure I see the immediate rule out of Erwin, who is Jim's brother. She says, can you elaborate more on this?
Yeah, so, and I'm sure I'm gonna kind of cover Erwin all here, and then you can go through the rest of your questions, Mike, and see if there's anything that I didn't hit on, because I saw there was a lot of questions about him.
Okay.
Yeah, so my rule out of Erwin, what I mean by that is, I'm not going to talk about Erwin anymore on the podcast. You know, as I said at the outset of the episode, we're reaching a point where I can't be covering things that are explaining what's happening in the active investigation right now, for a number of reasons, some legal, some practical, and sometimes you just don't want people to know exactly what you're up to when you're investigating. And I'm not saying that as some sort of subliminal message about Erwin. I mean, this is what I know about Erwin. Everything I said on the podcast, that's what I know about Erwin. I take that back. I do know more about him. There was more investigation into Erwin. And what I know is that I don't have any clear indications that he actually had anything to do with this. Erwin certainly could be said that he had a motive in the changed will, but keep in mind, at the time this happened, Jim's mom and Jim and Erwin's mom had indicated that she wanted to change the will, but we don't have any indication that she actually had yet. And the old will landed much more in Erwin's favor. Okay, so in the old will, everything was split up three ways. Jim's helping her with the lawyer to change the will to say that that Jim gets this one property, and there's, you know, the split. Basically, Erwin gets less than he would have had before. So Erwin breaking into the house and killing Jim and taking the old will is really counterproductive. Now, you could say that for someone to murder Jim, that maybe that would stop the process, but Jim's mom was still of sound mind. I mean, she still could have done what she was planning to do. Certainly that would eliminate one of the brothers to split things up with if there's only two instead of three. So you can see there's a potential for a motive there, but I honestly don't see it as a strong motive at all. I don't see it. Is this not enough of an estate where I would see it as someone's willing to murder their brother for it? That being said, it could be. You know, that could happen. When I say I'm ruling out, what I said in the episode was, unless we find some sort of conclusive evidence, forensic evidence, or some sort of witness testimony or something, you know, I don't have the authority or the power to subpoena Irwin's cell phone records or emails or anything like that. And the bottom line is there's no indication we have from Jim's side of any of his electronics that there was an ongoing conflict with Irwin. The conflict with those two had happened 4 years prior to that. So I don't think it is, even if we were still continuing on with this season, even if we had a long ways to go, I wouldn't be talking any more about Irwin because there's just no evidence that he actually did this. There's a potential for maybe a motive there. And we know there was some animosity, and Irwin could have had something to gain from this, and did actually have something to gain when Jim died in the distribution of their mother's property. But you know, you can't use that logic on Irwin and not use the same logic on Sandy. I don't think I see a strong enough motive for Sandy to do this either. And she would certainly have, you know, and in her case, it's two-handed. I mean, yeah, so there's this life insurance policy that's out there. And then, you know, Colleen Barnett says it'd be due to religion, whatever it is. Again, you know, none of those are strong motives, but there's a potential for a motive there. There's a reason. And in most cases, if you look at anyone, you can find a motive there. You can find, is there in any way a way that this person benefited from the death of the other person? And in most cases, even if it's something that's devastating, you can still find there was some benefit there. But I just want to be clear. I mean, keep in mind, this is just like Sandy, who lost her husband, just like Liz, who lost her dad. This is a man who lost his brother. And I'm not about to come out and tear this guy's life apart publicly because he may have had some motive there. Because one thing we have to always consider, and I wish people on the other side of our cases would do this as well, one thing you always have to consider is, what if you're wrong? When you're out there attacking Sandy Melgar, and when you're out there attacking Liz Rose, and just smearing their name all over the internet because you're convinced that Sandy murdered her husband and that Liz is somehow complicit in all this, or is trying to protect her mom and doesn't care, whatever the argument is, have you ever thought for a second that you might be fucking wrong? And when you think about that, if you can get, because I have to do this all the time, I have to check myself all the time and consider before, and this is a lesson I've learned over years, but before I go on the air and talk about somebody, I mean, if you noticed, I haven't given you the names, the full names of any of these suspects, unless it's somebody who is a convicted, documented person, for like Cineette Gonzalez. She absolutely was caught red-handed in that home invasion. No question about it. She pled guilty to it, and she went to prison for it, so I'll share her name. But the neighbor boy and even the victim's families, you got to ask yourself, if I come out this strong with this, what if I'm wrong? And what if you're wrong about Sandy? What if you're wrong and Sandy Melgar is actually innocent? Is there even a shred of regret for what you've done to this poor woman and what you've said about this poor woman because you assumed that you had to be right?
Now, Diane wants to know if Irwin might not have been directly involved in Jim's murder, but could have hired somebody. Is this a possibility you've considered?
Yeah, it's a possibility I've considered, but again, there's no evidence to support that. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a viable hypothesis or theory, but it's sheer speculation, and I don't have the ability or the authority to suss that out. You know, I that would take a forensic analysis of Irwin's phone records and email records and bank records to see if something like that happened. And since the police never did that, we don't have that. I can't assume that did happen. And the other thing is too, I mean, this scene does not at all read to me, nor does it read to Jim Clementi as a hired hit, nor does it look like this was an intentional homicide. I mean, Jim's read on the scene was the same as mine, that this was a homicide by accident. It was never the intention. These people didn't go into the Melgar's home with the intention of killing Jim. That happened after Jim started fighting back, and I think that's pretty clear from the medical evidence, the blood spatter evidence, from the profile of the crime scene. It does not at all look to me like this was an intentional murder. And kind of circling back, you got to remember too. So if this was, you know, Irwin trying to get his hands on the will, then why do it when the Melgars are home? Why kill Jim in his home? Why not break in if you're going to hire somebody? Have them break in when they're not home, or if they had to get to the safe, do it while Sandy's gone. She was about to leave. I mean, there's just. You just really have to fit a lot of square pegs into round holes in order for this to work. And again, I'll reiterate, I'm not closed-minded to any of these suspects actually being involved in this murder. What I'm saying when I say that we can rule them out barring any new evidence to indicate they were part of it is all I can work off of is the evidence that I have in front of me and have available to me. And based on that evidence, I see no connection. I see no proof that either Irwin or the housekeeper or Liz's ex had anything to do with this. You know, there are people, there may be persons of interest that the police, well, there's certainly people the police should have looked into back in 2012, and we wouldn't have all these unanswered questions. But as of right now, investigating this on the podcast, there's no reason, in my opinion, to drag these people's names through the mud with no evidence or proof to back anything up.
Liz says, just wanted to confirm that the safe has been opened at some point since the murder.
It has been on multiple occasions, and there was still stuff inside. I mean, based on what was left inside, you know, there was passports, there was some medication in there, there was birth certificates, even some jewelry that was inside the safe, which to me is a pretty good indication that it wasn't opened by the home invaders. They weren't able to get into it because I can't imagine they would get into it, take just the will out, leave the other things behind, and then close and lock the safe behind them. I don't think, and I think there'd be a lot more blood on the safe if that was the case. I think they made an attempt to open it, and as Jim was dying or slipping into unconsciousness, they couldn't get in and they got out of there.
Eva says, has anyone asked the families from the other home invasions about some recent jewelry purchases? If the people going into houses knew there was going to be new jewelry there, wouldn't the establishment where they got the jewelry be a good place to ask some questions?
Well, no. I mean, as I mentioned, I spoke with the woman I'm calling Isabel, the Kingwood home invasion victim. And then after I spoke with her briefly, we never had contact again, so I was never able to ask that question. I have reached out to the victim in the 2009 backyard barbecue home invasion a while ago, and didn't realize when I did so that she doesn't speak English, which I found through the police reports that we received later. But keep in mind, you know, because I thought, you know, I'm going to get in hold of them and see if they have a housekeeper, a maid, or if they bought any jewelry or, you know, all these things. But then I remember these home invaders were looking for the house with a safe behind the TV, and this family did not have that, which means they had the wrong house. So any information, it'll be difficult to connect Kingwood to that home invasions and even to the Milgars because it was the wrong house. So, and that's where, in my opinion, the police really dropped the ball on that one as well. I mean, they investigated that home invasion and the Kingwood home invasion far more thoroughly than they investigated Jim's murder. That is very clear from the police reports. They interviewed more people in the 2009 backyard barbecue home invasion than they did in a murder case in Jim's case. To give you an idea of the investigation that took place, if you compare it to other actual decent investigations, but they still, I think that they missed some opportunities, and in the fact that the home invaders kept saying there's supposed to be a safe behind the TV, we have the wrong house. If I was the lead investigator there, I'm knocking on every door in that neighborhood and asking who has a safe behind their TV, because that's where you're going to get your lead, that's where you're going to make the connection. So by finding out if the people who were actually assaulted had made any recent jewelry purchases or anything like that, that's not actually going to help us connect anything because I don't believe they were the intended target.
John says, despite having left weeks before, is it possible that the maid was an informant for the home invaders, telling them which houses had safes and other info?
Yeah, I the way he worded the question was, is it possible? Yes, anything is possible until we can rule it out. But much like with Irwin, there's just no evidence to support the idea that this housekeeper did this. I've looked a little deeper and done a little more investigation that we haven't talked about on the podcast, but she was a longtime employee of the Melgars. They trusted her. It was a sad time when she left and she moved far away. And it was, and I say weeks, but Sandy's not even sure exactly if I'm getting it kind of relayed through Liz. So hopefully Liz will correct me if I'm wrong on this, but you know, weeks could have been months. It was a quite a bit of time before this happened. She moved away. Now people have suggested that that could mean that she's, you know, that was the reason she moved away is to avoid suspicion. I mean, but think about it. What is she, again, my opinion of the crime scene is this was not an intentional murder. It was just a home invasion. There was nothing of incredible value in that safe. There was no money in it. There was some jewelry, not a lot. There is some medicine. There was nothing in there that's going to change someone's life to the point where I'm going to leave a job I've had for years with a family I've grown close to and move myself and my family 3 hours away into another location to distance myself from this crime scene so that this team can come in and rob the house of what? I mean, let's say somehow they walked out of that house with $10,000, okay? And which is much more than what was actually stolen. You know, there wasn't cash in the house that we're aware of other than what was likely in the Melgar's wallets. So it's $10,000. Certainly the people that did the burglary are going to want most of that. And so she's going to get, say she gets 10% of it, of $10,000. She's going to get $1,000. She uproots her whole life and leaves her job for $1,000. Or say it's $100,000. Let's say there was $100,000 in that safe and she gets 25% of it. Then, so she's got 25 grand. She has now uprooted her life, moved everything, lost all the jobs she worked for in the Houston area, moved 3 hours away, starting over with 25 grand. How long is that going to last? It just doesn't, there's no motive there for that. And it could be incidental, you know? I mean, there's a potential hypothesis that not that she moved away in order to distance herself, but it went the other way around where she's moving away. So since she's gone, she's going to go ahead and send these people in there. But again, what does she have to gain from this? You know, they say there's no honor amongst thieves. So she's moved away. So now she tells her buddies, hey, these people haven't. And what does she tell them? There's a safe. This is not a giant safe. It's a little safe in the corner of a closet. It looks like a firebox. It looks very similar to the safe that I have in my room. And guess what? There's no money in my safe either. I have all of our important documents. We have our home defense weapon in the safe that's all locked in there. That's all that's there. You know, I don't think that a lot of people that are living in a middle class or upper middle class neighborhood keep safes in their houses that are full of millions of dollars. You know, they like in the movies where, you know, they move the picture and open the safe up in the wall and there's stacks of cash in there. Nobody does that. And I don't think anybody would think that someone was doing that. Certainly not in Jim and Sandy's case. There's no indication from what we know and likely from what a housekeeper would know that there's anything in that safe other than just some important papers. You know, they've never displayed that they have tons and tons and tons of cash laying around. You know, again, just like with Irwin and with Liz's ex, you can find a way for someone to have benefited from the death or from the burglary, but you can do that with just about anybody, and I just see no connection there with the housekeeper. But again, that being said, if further investigation finds there was some sort of connection, she's connected with other home invaders, or there's forensic evidence, which would be tough and for her case because she was in the house regularly and cleaned it, but unless we find some sort of connection there, I don't think it's worth even speculating, certainly not publicly, that this woman may have had something to do with the burglary and Jim's death, because there's just nothing there to warrant that other than speculation.
Tracy says, I was wondering about the safe company and if they have employees that deliver the safes or install them in customers' homes. Could this be a possible link to similar home invasions like Kingwood in the backyard barbecue crimes?
No, I don't think so, for a couple of reasons. One, the Kingwood home invasion family didn't have a safe, and the Melgar safe was not something you have brought in from a safe installer. If you look at the crime scene photos, you're talking about a safe that's maybe, I don't know, what, 16 inches by 12 inches by 16? Yeah. This is a safe that you'd buy at Walmart or something like that, like a firebox like that. It's not something you have a company come in and install for you. It's a store-bought safe.
Rodney says, what about the cable guy or satellite installer? What do you think of that?
That's interesting when it comes to the 2009 home invasion, because they said the safe was behind the TV. So that's why I thought maybe a housekeeper could have directed somebody towards that. But yeah, a cable installer would be one too. But then there's no connection that we're aware of with the Kingwood family, because they didn't have a safe. And there was no other indications they knew anything about the house other than they thought they were looking for a safe. And then with the Melgars, there was no recent cable. They didn't even have cable, remember? They just had homemade antennas that Jim would make, so they could have free TV. So they didn't even have cable. So no, I don't think a cable installer is viable.
All right, this one's from Karen regarding Oscar Garcia. She says, I searched the registered address of the cell phone number found in Sinead's phone regarding the Kingwood home invasion, and it brought me to a case which is a potential wrongful conviction of a man named Omar Hutchison. He was sentenced to 23 years due to police and DA stating a cell phone belonged to him. Civil rights activist S.E. Rerun Barry tracked the phone and the P.O. box attached to it, which came out of Irvine, California. It's believed that was the same address that this phone was listed under.
Yeah, I saw this post by Karen on the fan page, and if you're on the fan page, track that post down and read it, because there's a whole article there. But yeah, it further confirms to me that Sinead and her family were connected. Well, we know that her family is connected to Colombian organized crime, and this is further confirmation. So if you remember in the episode when they ran, a couple episodes ago, when they ran the phone number from Yosistas. Also, by the way, apparently, when I tried to clarify that last week, I made it even worse because I spelled it twice in two different ways. So Yosistas, Mike is shaking his head at me right now in disparaging disappointment. But it's spelled Yosistas. So it's like Yas, Y-O-S, and then Sistas with an A-S at the end. Or Yassi, Y-O-S-S-I, and then Stas, S-T-A-S. But anyway, that phone number, when police ran it, remember, it was registered to a man named Anonymous Lee, which is clever, I think, and it was registered to a P.O. box out of Irvine, California. And what this article is saying is that there was a string of, again, organized criminals that are using the same number, that phone number. I don't remember if it was that phone number or if it was the P.O. box in the background search.
I think it was just the P.O. box. I guess it's the phone and the P.O. box attached to it.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, the phone and the P.O. box attached to it. So it's registered in the same Irvine, California P.O. box as where the customer registered the phone to. So it's a common method used by this group of organized criminals. And that, again, connects it right back to Sinead, because that was the number she was contacting and talking to about the Kingwood home invasion in the day leading up to it. And again, as she was being caught by the victims on the side of the road, she was getting texts from this person. So interesting, and just more to the point that I think that there's something, as Wendell Mass had said on the fan page, and I think we talked a little bit about it last week, that the idea of there being some sort of federal informant involved in these cases that are causing a lot of the unanswered questions that we have seem to point back towards this criminal informant angle. And we know that there were Colombian CIs involved in some of these cases because it's in the police reports. We know there were U.S. Marshals involved, and we know that there's a whole lot of stuff missing out of these files that should be there.
Ross says, before we move on to the next season, what is the status of the examination of the surveillance video?
Yeah, as of right now, I'm still waiting on Grant Fredericks. I don't know if he's going to even get to it. So Mike Ware from the Innocence Project connected me to Grant and asked if he'd be willing to look at this video. I emailed him and told him, hey, I just got this 16 seconds of video I want you to look at. He said, sure, I'm willing to do it. I think I got a little bit overly in-depth with my production to him. I wanted to give him all the information necessary. So I sent him a series of videos. Here's reference video number one to show a car going from left to right. Here's reference video number two, a car going right to left. So there were reference videos and the other clips. And I sent scene diagrams and showed him, you know, where the camera coverage was. So he knew what he was looking at. I sent him this whole case file, and he did email me back. He's super busy. He emailed me back last week and said, "But you know, I thought I was just looking at a quick video, Bob. I don't have time right now to go through all of this." And so I did send him a message back saying, "Well, okay, here's the one video," and let him know that, you know, we're willing to pay him for his time to analyze it. And I haven't heard back, but from talking to Mike Ware and things, I know that Grant is swamped with work, and his initial thought was just, you know, quick looking at a little video, and it turned into this much deeper analysis. So I think it'll be coming eventually. We'll get it back from Grant. I was hoping to get it back much quicker than we have. And if and when I get his results back, then we'll come back in with that, and I'll explain that in an episode when it happens.
Rebecca says, I'm curious about how you pick a new case to cover. How many do you go through before deciding on one? I'm sure you get inundated with requests to look at cases.
We do, and there's no number. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, I guess a good number is a lot.
We're constantly getting pitched cases. I mean, that never stops. And we are only looking for a case when we're wrapping up one. So we kind of build up this backlog over the course of years to go back through and filter out, you know, cases that might interest us on the show, along with we usually put out like an APB on the show in real time asking for new cases. So we've always got a lot going on there.
Yeah, and that's when it gets really, like you said, we're always getting pitched. And I do review them. You know, I usually don't bring Mike into that process unless it's something that is a potential, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, so, well, you know, I might look through 10, 15 in a month that just, they're not, and sometimes just doesn't fit our criteria. You know, we're typically going to cover cases that involve murder, and I want to truly believe the person is innocent before I start it, and then we try to start back from that neutral point. But if there's nothing there, if when I'm reading the case file, I'm looking like, I think this person very likely did it, and I can't see any indications that they didn't, then that doesn't, you know, we don't forget about them, but that doesn't usually make the final cut. And then there's just so much more that goes into that decision as we're filtering through all of them. You know, there's, I mean, from a production standpoint, it's kind of how the sausage is made, but, you know, we're looking at, are there audio assets, meaning are there recorded police interviews? Are there recorded trial, trial proceedings? Are there witnesses that are alive? Are there people we can talk to? Is the prison the person is in, are they somewhere where we can talk to them? Do they have clear phone connections? Does the person have a voice that you can hear? You know, that was one of the bummers here about season six was we haven't heard from Sandy hardly at all. And again, we're always kind of learning. I mean, not to say that I regret in any way, shape, or form taking this case. I am just as passionate, if not more so, about this case than a lot of the other ones we've worked. You know, this is an absolute tragedy, and I really think that we're helping, and we're gonna hopefully end up with Sandy going home. But you know, one of the things we found out was very early on, we knew we could talk to her. I know the Texas system. I know we can talk to her and record calls. And what I didn't count on is the fact that we couldn't hear her for the first however long, and then she had phone issues, and then she got moved, and then she's in the medical unit, and then she's not allowed to record interviews anymore. So I would have liked for you all to hear more from Sandy along the way, and that just wasn't possible. So that's something, because of that, me knowing that I wanted you to hear more from Sandy this year or this season, and you weren't able to, you know, is that something that we can do? Or can we hear from this person? Can you get to know the person that's in prison? You know, and so there's just a million things, but the primary driving force is the case. That's why we have the case submission form through our website. So without talking to anyone or hearing or anything that could influence in any way, I'm looking specifically at the case itself to determine if it moves on to the next step. And then, you know, like Mike said, we're constantly mid-season, I'll read one of those. Oh, this one looks interesting, and I'll send over to Mike. And a lot of times I'll have Mike start doing some of the initial research on it. And then, you know, we kind of have those flagged for when we're actually ready to look at a case. But the saddest part about it is, especially after the 2020 show, I mean, we got still getting flooded. Every time they rerun that, we get a flood of everything from calls to emails to forums. People want us to look at their cases. The sad part is, you know, the case we're moving forward with season 7, I think, is a great case, and I cannot wait to get it started. I think you guys are going to love it. But the sad thing is, you know, there was at least 5 other cases that we looked at that I think, you know, were potentials. They're cases that we could have used, and we could have went that way, but there was just other elements of this particular case that led us to choosing this one, and then maybe circle back to those in another season. And you know, and as I mentioned a couple months ago when we announced that we're starting to wind down season 6, is that, you know, format wise, this we've had a couple seasons, this one included, that went a full year, and we're gonna try to make those a little tighter and not have the cases go on, so each season go on for as long, and continue doing our work that we're always doing behind the scenes and come back with updates. So we'll be cycling through cases more frequently, I hope, moving forward.
Matthew wants to know, what more can be done or can the listeners do to help Sandra after the season ends?
You know, the biggest thing that you can do for Sandy is to write to her. Honestly, I think, you know, and spread the word about the podcast. And you know, we're done with it, but it's on the internet. It's there forever to let more people know about our case. Keep putting pressure where pressure needs to be placed. But, you know, prison's hard for a lot of reasons. And I think the one thing that people on the outside don't realize is just how incredibly difficult and isolating it is to not have contact with the outside world, to not, you know, to have to fight and save and for anything to read. And you're only talking to the same people. And I know with every person we've worked with, you know, when Jesse Eldridge calls me, the first thing he always says is he is all excited about all the letters that he got since last time we talked. It was the same thing when Ed was in prison, and with Kenny Snow and Sandra and George Powell, all these people, it makes such a massive difference to them to be able to, when mail call comes around, that they can pull out a stack of letters and just read, and just people they can write to and talk to and just hear about what's going on with their lives, and just knowing that there are people out there that care about them. I think that, you know, and the easiest thing that anybody could do to continue to help Sandy is to write to her and let her know you're supporting her. You know, as things come up with the case itself, at this point, as we're going to talk about on Sunday, you know, there's a point where I need to start even backing off with the case itself, and we'll talk about that, as I said, on Sunday. So there's not a lot we can do with it as far as the investigation goes, but with the information that's out there, if there's leads that you notice and things, if you share them with us and we can get them to the defense attorneys and make sure that those leads are being followed up on. But anything you do to spread the word about the reward, that's huge. And we're doing that. We're going to talk about that on Sunday as well. You know, just somehow we've got to crack this thing open. But I don't know from a listener standpoint, as we move forward, that there's a lot you can do. The biggest thing for Sandy is to just help keep her spirits up. Write to her. Let her know you care. Let her know you support her. And also, you know, we still haven't corrected the medical situation. So, you know, go to the Free Sandy Melgar page. Get the information there. If you haven't already done that, go and write through the letter writing campaign to try to get Sandy the proper medical care that she deserves and she needs while she's in prison.
Lauren says, can we review the Harris County appellate brief? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, real brief. It was a short document. And for those of you that aren't on social media, you don't realize the Harris County DA's office had filed an extension and was granted to July 1st to reply to the Sechrest appellate brief for Sandy. I think it was Monday or Friday, they finally did file their response brief early. Late, but earlier than their deadline, their latest deadline. It's short. It's 41 pages long. It's a pretty quick read. And to me, it reads the same way that most of them read, you know, because a lot of people were reading the response and they're like, they're so pissed off. And why are they twisting this and doing that? And it looks bad, or because you know, they sound they're making a case. Remember, this is an unchallenged document, just like when the secrets filed theirs. Everything looks great when they file theirs, then the state responds to them and they try to make it look bad. It's because it's unchallenged. It's normal. They're only stating the strong points or what they view as strong points of their case. Me personally, I think that it was not terribly well written, and I read into it a slight sense of desperation on the part of the prosecution. And I say that because there's some things in the brief that they absolutely, I mean, they're filling pages. They've written things into the brief that they absolutely know are going to do them no good. So keep in mind that for direct appeals, you cannot bring in new evidence. You have to work only off the record, which means the trial transcripts and the exhibits that were put into the record during the trial. And so we see, you know, the whole controversy that's gone on about the computer logins, and that, you know, there's that Eric Devlin testified that there was no human activity on the computer, but his forensic report shows that there was an incorrect login, and I think 1102 doesn't say AM or PM, and then another one at like 1139 or somewhere around there, a successful login. There's a whole lot of drama surrounding that. I'm not getting into it. As I've said a long time ago, I don't know anything about these computers. I've never spoken to Eric Devlin. I am only taking the word from the people that have contacted them, from the Seacrest, from the people that are claiming these are actual logins. I don't know the answer. I have no way of knowing the answer. But what I do know is, in the record, that report, the forensic report, was submitted into evidence, and it was submitted into evidence while Eric Devlin was testifying, and Eric Devlin responded to direct questions and said on the record that there was no human activity on those computers during the time in question. So while I say there's some acts of desperation there, the state included that in their response brief. Their points that they're putting in there is that there was submitted into the record a report that shows that there was this incorrect login, as though and when you're reading it, and I'm sure the people that are in support of that are hooraying over that it made it in the report. It means nothing. The person that wrote it in there knows it means nothing, because they can only work off the record. Whether it's legitimate or not, it does not matter. Much the same as any new evidence that we can come up with does not matter in the direct appeal. Because I'm not speaking for Mack or Allison. I have no idea what they're going to do with this. For me, when I'm reading it, I was like, well, that's two lines in there, because the defense gets the final word. So they get to file one more response, and that's it. And then it goes to either a ruling or a hearing. But all they put is that information in that report was testified to on behalf of the expert, testified to it, the person that wrote the report, and he said right here on this page in this paragraph, there's no human activity. And it's done. It won't be considered. But it's irrelevant to the case, based on my limited legal understanding. But it's telling to me that the state is trying to wedge that in there. It tells me a couple things. It tells me, one, that very likely the original prosecutor, Colleen Barnett, is probably in the appellate attorney's ear constantly trying to wedge that in there. But it also tells me that they know they don't have much of an argument. If in order to fill only 41 pages, they had to add that, knowing that it's going to mean nothing, to me that seems very telling. The main point of the defense's brief, of Mack and Allison's brief, is the insufficiency of evidence. Basically, that the jury convicted wrongly. They were wrong when they convicted because there was not sufficient evidence to support the conviction. And so most of this brief that the state filed in response to that is saying how the jury's free to interpret the evidence the way they interpret it, and it's the jury's job to make a decision. They made the decision, so it doesn't matter what the evidence is. And as I'm reading it, I'm just that's the point. The entire point, and all the case law cited by Mack, the entire point is that the jury interpreted the evidence wrong. And so Mack makes a point of error. Has this point of error in the appeals brief that says the jury misinterpreted the evidence. They convicted on insufficient evidence. No logical trier of fact could have seen this evidence and came to the conclusion that Sandy is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then the state's response is, well, the jury gets to decide and decipher the evidence. It's almost just like a circular argument. Like, what do you mean? Obviously, yeah, I was expecting them to bullet point all of the points that Mac made, saying, well, this is, they're saying this, but that's incorrect because of this, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, they're just saying the jury gets to decide the facts, whereas Mac is saying the jury decided the facts incorrectly because there was not sufficient evidence. Essentially what, and I'm talking in circles now, but essentially what the original appeal brief from Mac is saying is the jury did not do a good job. They got this wrong. So because the jury did not decipher the evidence properly, judges, we want you to look at the evidence and you tell me if you think this was sufficient evidence. That's the whole point of that point of error. So basically, long babbling, cut down very short. I personally think that, you know, and again, not a lawyer, not a legal expert. I do read a lot of these, and I've seen how they get decided in a lot of ways. I have no prediction of how this is going to get decided. But to me, that was a pretty weak response brief back to, which could mean a couple things. You know, it could just mean they don't have much of an argument. It could mean that the appellate side of Harris County is not digging their heels in and fighting hard. They're not so confident in the conviction. They're certainly not enough to really, you know, they're not Thiru Vignaraja, who is the prosecutor in Anand Syed's case, who was just fighting and scrapping and lying and doing everything that he can possibly do to stop Anand Syed from going free. I did not get that impression from this brief at all. They're trying to find elements of the law to support their side of the case. And in my opinion, they did not do a great job of doing that. And that's no insult to them. I just don't think there's much of an argument to be made. I think that Mac's argument that the jury convicted on insufficient evidence was a sound argument. That's my opinion.
Okay. And lastly, Bob, there is another new Netflix show coming out today.
There is. And so this is dropping Friday, the 28th of June. And today on Netflix, the show Exhibit A is being released, and episode one of Exhibit A is all about the George Powell case, our season four case, and we've been looking forward to this for a long time. I can't wait to watch it, so you definitely need to tune into that. But on the topic of George Powell, right before Mike and I started to record this interview, I got a call from Mike Ware, the executive director of the Innocence Project of Texas, the person who is representing George Powell. And he called to let me know that the Court of Criminal Appeals has made a ruling in George's case. So as you remember, the lower court, during his post-conviction relief hearings, threw out George's conviction, but in Texas, that automatically then gets sent up to the Court of Criminal Appeals for them to either confirm or deny the judge's ruling. We got that ruling, and Mike was kind enough to hop on a call real quick with me. The sound quality's not great. He was literally driving down the road when he got the ruling, and he pulled over into a Starbucks to give me a call to tell me what happened. So here's Mike. Mike, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Bob. Can you hear me?
I can. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm actually pulled over in a Starbucks. Is it too noisy in here?
No, it's fine. I'll just tell everybody you're in a Starbucks when they hear it.
Okay. I got the news when I was on the road, and so I pulled over to call you and to hopefully get a chance to look at the opinion, which I haven't even looked at yet.
Okay. So fill us in on what you know. So this is all kind of breaking. This just happened, but the Court of Criminal Appeals has issued a ruling in George's case. And what did they rule?
Well, you know, this happened just about an hour ago. And while I was on the road, I got the news of it. And they basically went with the trial court and found that the prosecutors had committed prosecutorial misconduct, which denied George a fair trial, and that he should have a new trial. Now, what's real odd about it is that they did not even acknowledge our actual innocence claim. They did not even acknowledge our junk science claim. So they didn't address any of the Grant Frederick's testimony and evidence. They didn't address any of the Michael Knox junk science testimony and evidence. They just found that there was serious prosecutorial misconduct and that George should have a new trial. Now, I haven't even had a chance, because George is in lockdown I haven't even had a chance to tell him the news yet. So we're trying to set up a telephone conference with him. But so this is all something that's happened within the last hour.
Okay, so the good news is at this point his conviction is vacated.
And, correct.
And so he will be, he's granted a new trial. I mean, I know it's hard to predict, but I mean, do you foresee them going forward with a new trial, knowing that you have Grant Frederick's expert testimony that'll be coming in?
Well, there's all sorts of, we've got all sorts of things to decide and do before that even really becomes an issue. One is, I anticipate we will file a motion for reconsideration with the Court of Criminal Appeals, pointing out that they did not address our actual innocence claim. So that can put a whole new timeline on this. There's a lot I can say about that, but I probably should wait and not comment on that particular topic right now.
Okay. So they didn't deny the claims of for the junk science or the actual innocence. They just didn't acknowledge them. Is that something that the CCA can do where they, you know, will give a rule on that later, or is this their final word on the matter at this point, unless you file reconsideration with them?
Well, this is their final word on the matter until and unless they, you know, consider a motion for rehearing or reconsideration, unless they decide to revisit the issue. So there's actually some case law that says when an actual innocence claim is raised, they have to at least address it. And so it's just unusual that they did not even address it.
Okay, so I'm sure at this point you have a lot of planning to do to figure out where to go next with that. What issues of, do you know, because you haven't read the brief yet, but or the opinion yet, do you know which issues of prosecutorial misconduct were raised?
Well, yeah, I know what they were. I raised them, so I know which ones were raised. The prosecutors intentionally suborned perjury with the jailhouse informant. They solicited perjury from him, and they knew it was perjury, and they failed to correct it. And then they even argued it to the jury, his perjured testimony. So that is one claim. The other is they had a deal with the jailhouse informant, and they failed to disclose that deal to the defense. And they even lied and said he didn't have a deal when he did. So that's the prosecutorial misconduct.
And the Court of Criminal Appeals confirmed both of those issues.
Correct.
Okay. So we've got a lot happening moving forward. And I know you're still on the road and itching to actually read the rest of the opinion. So I'll let you go. I appreciate you taking a minute to call us in and to call in and update us on all of this. And this is, it's interesting in the light of Mike and I were just getting ready to record this week's Friday episode, and we were going to be discussing that on Friday the Netflix documentary Exhibit A comes out, and the first episode features George's case.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and it's going to be all about the forensics, which were ignored by the Court of Criminal Appeals. That's pretty interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, that is pretty baffling. I wonder if the judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals panel will watch the Netflix episode.
Well, I hope so. They evidently didn't pay any attention to what the Texas Forensic Science Commission found. But like I said, we have a long ways to go on this case.
Okay, well, that's great. Then, Mike, I'm going to let you go, and I'm looking forward to that. Episode is going to drop on Friday. So when the listeners are hearing this today, we're going to get to see Exhibit A on Netflix. And Mike, again, thank you so much for taking the time to call into us.
Well, thank you, Bob. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. So we got some really good news in the George Powell case. As you heard from Mike, we got a long way to go, different options. But ultimately, the good news is here is George Powell's conviction has been thrown out. And at this point, we're still fighting for his actual innocence. And there's a few different ways that can be tackled. And as with all of our cases, we will come back with any updates. But for now, this is perfect timing that this ruling came down today, because when you're done watching this tonight, when you settle in, make sure you turn on Netflix and check out episode 1 of Exhibit A, all about George Powell. And coming up on Sunday will be our season 6 finale episode. So make sure you tune in for that. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Mike Bussing is our executive producer, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Thank you to Amanda Meyer with Willow Photo and Design for designing and creating our Friday follow-up logo. And all of our font across all of our logos and banners was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Rachel Timberman, Natalie Alicia, Pamela Westby, Katherine Chrisman, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. And if you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter. The show's handle is @TruthJusticePod, and my personal Twitter handle is @BobRuffTruth. And for more personal interactions, feel free to follow me on Instagram @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget, we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Say goodbye to the dish and hello to Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky over Wi-Fi. So you can get unmissable Sky shows like The Last of Us and Succession, as well as Netflix and Discovery Plus, and loads more, all in one subscription for £26 a month. Oh, and next day delivery with no upfront fee. Sky Stream, TV simplified. Head to sky.com. Requires Sky Stream and broadband minimum speed 10 megabits per second, 18-month minimum term. Cut-off times apply for next day delivery. Excludes bank holiday. 18 plus, terms apply.